Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with the CBS World News Roundup. Secretary of State Vance today is flying from Jordan to Saudi Arabia. Next stop in his brief swing through the Middle East to explain the Egyptian-Israeli agreements reached at Camp David. Yesterday in Amman, Jordan's King Hussein promised to give those agreements serious consideration, but he didn't say whether he would join the peace talks with Israel. Now, as we hear from Bernard Kalb, Vance will test the temperature in Riyadh.
The stop in Saudi Arabia is the most crucial in Vance's sprint through the Middle East aimed at defusing criticism of the Camp David Accords. The Saudis have enormous wealth because of their oil. They've sprinkled money throughout the area in support of their Arab brothers. And while it's an exaggeration to say what the Saudis want, the Saudis always get, it is a fact that Saudi wealth has given that desert kingdom far-ranging influence in the Mideast as well as in the West. Their reaction to Camp David has disturbed the Americans, to put it mildly. The Saudis have charged that the Accords cannot be considered a final acceptable formula for peace. And what Vance will try to do is to explain why the Accords, in the American view, represent the best chance for peace. No one expects the Saudis to do a sudden flip-flop just because they've heard from Vance. The Americans recognize that just blunting Saudi criticism will be an uphill fight. But they're hoping that the initial Saudi blast is not their last word on the subject. There's also the hope that U.S.-Saudi divisions on the Accords will not affect U.S.-Saudi relations. The Saudis represent the most important source of U.S. imported oil. Bernard Kalb, CBS News, traveling with Secretary Vance in the Middle East.
President Carter is meeting today at the White House with Sudan's President Jafar Numeri to see what Numeri thinks about the Camp David summit. No doubt about what a lot of other Arab leaders are saying about it. They're holding a summit conference in Damascus, and Doug Tunnell has the story there.
In a strongly worded opening address, Syrian President Hafez al-Assad charged Anwar Sadat with casting the Arab world into a time of darkness by turning his back on the Arabs and signing a unilateral agreement with Israel. He asked what he called the painful question, will the time come when Egypt will join Israel, he said, and wage a war against the Arabs. But not all the rhetoric here has been quite so grim. The Damascus summit opened with a lot of laughing and joking around the conference table and words of encouragement as a result of the largely unfavorable reaction to the Camp David Accords in Saudi Arabia and other Arab Gulf states. Assad praised King Hussein of Jordan for his stand on the agreements, while PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat lashed out at the American role in Camp David. Assad did not. He has agreed to meet with Secretary of State Cyrus Vance this weekend. And according to Syrian officials, Assad will present Vance with the details of Syria's own Mideast summit during their talks. Doug Tunnell, CBS News, Damascus.
Israeli troops today used force to remove squatters from illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank region. The squatters, who claim that the Jewish people have a God-given right to all of the biblical land of Israel, were taken away in trucks and buses. The Federal Reserve Board's latest move to tighten up the money supply has come under fire from Robert McKinney, chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. That in itself is unusual because government banking and monetary agencies rarely criticize each other in public. What got McKinney's dander up was news from the Fed's chairman, G. William Miller, that the Fed has set a new interest rate target of 8.5%, up from 8 3/8. The last time the Fed's interest rate was as high as 8.5 was in 1974. Yesterday, McKinney issued a statement saying, for the moment, the bank board will do all in its power to counterbalance that action by the Fed. And he added, I sincerely hope that still further tightening by the Fed will not be necessary because, McKinney added, it could lead to a collapse in the whole housing market now booming. He contends that the Fed's action in tightening credit could divert money from savings and loan and thus make mortgage money harder and more expensive to obtain. Republican leaders riding their anti-tax bandwagon are preaching the word today in the Middle West. Details from Neil Strasser.
Today begins in Detroit, continues in Minneapolis-St. Paul, and winds up tonight in Chicago before the Republicans move on west with their tax blitz. Everywhere, the message sounded by Republican National Chairman William Brock will be the same. Give us some more Republicans this fall, and every family in the country will have a tax cut next year. Brock has forged an extraordinary amount of party unity behind the single issue. Both conservative and liberal Republicans are making all or part of the trip in support of the Roth-Kemp tax cut plan. That plan holds that federal taxes can be cut by a third over a 3-year period and still at no expense in services. because in theory the economy would be stimulated, more Americans put to work, and tax revenues actually increased. Even some of the Republicans along on the trip have misgivings about the claims for the plan, and liberal economists say the Republicans are peddling snake oil, a panacea that sounds good but won't work. But for Republicans, the approach has the advantage of sounding much more positive than the old budget-cutting theme, which split even Republicans, and they think it has a sound that voters want to hear. Neil Strauser, CBS News, Detroit.
240 of Bridgeport, Connecticut's 1,250 public school teachers are behind bars this morning, jailed for disobeying a back-to-work court order and continuing their week-old strike for higher pay. And Rich Holter of station WCCO reports that their predicament is getting special attention in a suburb of Minneapolis, a suburb where a teacher strike is also in progress.
For the third straight day, the 600 Burnsville, Minnesota teachers are manning the picket lines instead of the classroom, and the district's 12 schools remain closed to some 11,000 students. National Education Association President John Ryer met with the teachers yesterday and called the jailing of striking teachers in Bridgeport, Connecticut, an irrational community response to a teacher request to stay even with inflation.
And it's the lose-lose proposition. You can't get justice, you force them out in the street, and then teach them a lesson by putting them in prison. Now that's what makes teachers angry. And that's why we've got problems with bargaining in the United States of America. Because there is no justice for the public employee.
The Burnsville teachers' strike, which like Bridgeport is centered on wages, is a legal action, and no arrests are expected. A mediation session is planned later today, but both sides are well entrenched, and both have predicted a lengthy strike. Rich Holter for CBS News, Minneapolis.
The vexing problem of Namibia, Southwest Africa, is coming up again today at the United Nations, and we'll hear about it from Richard C. Hottolet.
Members of the Security Council consult today about a showdown with South Africa over the question of Namibia. South Africa's decision to authorize elections in Namibia 2 months from now has cut across the Western plan for Namibia's peaceful transition to independence. The five Western members of the Security Council, Britain, France, Canada, West Germany, and the United States, want elections there well prepared over a period of 7 months, with a large United Nations presence guaranteeing that the result is fair and internationally acceptable. The Western Five believe that the Security Council must now meet what they see as South Africa's challenge of the whole scheme, laboriously negotiated over the past 18 months. They want the Council to meet next week and approve Secretary General Waldheim's blueprint for the UN supervisory and security machinery. The Council would also call upon all states to cooperate in setting it up. If South Africa did not comply, the Council could consider the African nation's long-standing request for sharp economic sanctions. The Western Five, who have vetoed sanctions in the past, might find it hard to do so again. Richard C. Hottle at CBS News, United Nations.
South Africa's decision to hold elections in Namibia was disclosed yesterday by Prime Minister Forster at the same time he announced his resignation. His successor will be elected at a caucus of the ruling National Party next week. The U.S. Navy has a plan afoot to overhaul the aircraft carrier Saratoga, which will be 24 years old in 1980 when the overhaul is supposed to begin. And a dispute has developed between Philadelphia and Newport News, Virginia, over where the work will be done. Tomorrow, the General Accounting Office is expected to release a report concluding that it would be nearly $100 million cheaper to overhaul the Saratoga at private shipyards in Newport News than it would be at the Navy Yard in Philadelphia. Ike Pappas takes this tangled tale from there.
The GAO report is not going to be good news to Vice President Walter Mondale. Earlier this year, Mondale personally announced that Philadelphia would get the work to make up for an earlier broken campaign promise by Mondale that the Army would not close the Frankfort Arsenal near Philadelphia. Representative Paul Tribble of Virginia, who is leading the fight to have the overhaul work done at Newport News, says Mondale wants American tax money to pay off his political debt.
The vice president announced the decision that the Saratoga would go to Philadelphia, and he advanced as the reason for that decision the administration's failure to keep its promise to keep open the Frankfort Army Arsenal. And he said, this ship will make up for the jobs lost at the Frankfort Army Arsenal.
The Navy is in the process of reconsidering its original decision to do the work in Philadelphia. A final decision is expected early next year. Ike Pappas, CBS News, Washington.
The New Jersey Supreme Court this morning upheld the criminal contempt conviction of New York Times reporter Myron Farber and of The Times for refusing to turn over his notes in the Mario Juskalovich murder case. The court ordered Farber back to jail September 26th. In a 5-2 decision, the court rejected the newspaper's and Farber's argument that his notes are protected by the First Amendment and New Jersey Shield laws. Former President Ford is testifying today before the House Assassinations Committee about the way the Warren Commission investigated the murder of President Kennedy. Mr. Ford, then a member of Congress, was a member of the commission. In today's testimony, the former president is saying he thinks the Warren Commission did its work well, and Mr. Ford adds that he has seen no evidence to make him change his mind.